Do you remember a time when Britain was normal? It might seem a distant memory, but a new book argues it was not so long ago. The collapse of liberal Britain seems to have happened in a flash. So what does it all mean, and what happens next?
So this is it, the final chapter, the end of the road. A 47-year political experiment that the British, frankly, have never been very happy with.
If you ask yourselves, what is this new government going to do? What is he going to do with his extraordinary majority? I will tell you, that is what we are going to do. We are going to unite and level up.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Zoe Williams. Today we're joined by Will Davis, a professor of political economy at Goldsmiths University of London and co-director of the Political Economy Research Centre. We're talking to him about his new book, This Is Not Normal, The Collapse of Liberal Britain, which is out now with Verso. It's published at a moment where Brexit has, formally at least, and tragically you might say, happened. It takes stock of what the last 4 years have taught us about our politics, our media, and our democratic institutions. As usual, you can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. An extended version of this pod is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible, the campaign group that acts as the home of the European left in Britain. By joining us, you participate in our movement-building efforts to confront injustice and promote grassroots internationalism. To join, support our work, and gain access to an extended version of this pod, go to anothereurope.org/join.
Britain is no longer part of the European Union. It marks the end of more than 3 years of fighting over Brexit.
And we're working for the day when life will be back to normal.
So, Will, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was reading your book, obviously, and I was also watching the acceptance speeches of David Cameron in 2015 and Boris Johnson in 2019 in prep for this discussion. That's the kind of geek that I am. It might seem like a small thing, but Boris Johnson, in his four-minute speech on the Downing Street steps, didn't thank his opponents, didn't say anything about them at all. And whatever you think of David Cameron, he was actually quite gracious in victory. His words towards Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband were really quite warm.
Ed Miliband rang me this morning to wish me luck with the new government. It was a typically generous gesture from someone who is clearly in public service for all the right reasons.
Is that a cultural distinction that I felt was quite important to what you're arguing in This Is Not Normal? Or am I completely barking up the wrong tree here?
No, I don't think you're barking up the wrong tree. I think that that's a symptom of something that developed over the four-year period that my book is about, which is between the referendum of 2016 and through to the period after Britain leaving the European Union in 2020. And I think it's a symptom of the fact that when liberal democracies are functioning in a half-healthy fashion, that participants in political disputes must in some ways pay some respect to the broader institutions within which political differences take place, whether that be within Parliament, within the institutions of the electoral system, within the forums provided by the mainstream media and the broadcasters and so on. And what has happened, I think, heavily to do with Brexit, obviously, but also to do with the different style of leadership that someone like Johnson has brought and the way in which his relationship to the media, which is really unlike any other politician that's come before, is that political campaigns such as that of the Vote Leave, but also that of Boris Johnson, in some sense take aim squarely at those institutions that in the past provided the kind of holding environment within which political disputes and arguments and competitions took place. And that, in a sense, is a feature of what broadly gets called populism, in the sense that the institutions, not just of a particular political party or a particular sector of business, whatever it might be, but the very institutions that make public life possible and make the mainstream political arguments possible are taken aim at and treated as being non-representative of the public interest, as being out of touch with the people. And therefore, there is no obligation, as you're pointing out, to actually pay respect to the kind of perimeter of consensus that one shares with one's opponent, because ultimately, the question of what one nevertheless shares with opponents, in spite of whoever is up and who is down ceases to be a factor in this kind of populist environment, because ultimately what you're trying to do is to undermine the very foundations on which consensual and ultimately peaceful outcomes are possible. And this is why it is really a crisis for liberalism as such.
So we talk about normal in lots of different ways. And this year, I think we use it as a negative. So we say no return to normal as a way of objecting to business as usual economics. But in the book, you mean normal in a different way to kind of cover things, you know, more related to civility. And a related distinction you draw is between neoliberalism on the one hand and liberalism on the other. So can you give us that rough guide distinguishing between a liberal and a neoliberal?
The title of the book, This Is Not Normal, is partly just sort of speaking of a general sense that I think many people share at the moment, that something has broken down in the way in which British politics happens, which isn't to say that everything was rosy by any means before 2016, but simply to say that we now seem to be on a kind of rather disorientating path that we don't really know where it leads, and that certain aspects of it are not recognisable. So it's not to say that we need to somehow kind of revive some normality that existed merely 4 or 5 years ago, but that we are currently operating without any clear and identifiable set of norms and institutions that seem to actually be up to the job of navigating and constraining the kind of politics that is at large at the moment. As far as liberalism and neoliberalism are concerned, I think that there are a couple of key distinctions, and this is, I suppose, something that a lot of sociologists and historians of economics have written about, and I've written about myself in some of my work. I think one of the key distinctions is that liberalism, as a both a political philosophy but also a model of a political economy, and this dates back really to the Enlightenment, is premised on a separation of different spheres of society. So most importantly, as people like Karl Polanyi and others have observed somewhat critically and suspiciously, that the liberal vision of society is one which separates the sphere of the economy from the sphere of the state and the sphere of politics from the sphere of economics. And this is something that many people on the left have been very critical of over the last 200, 300 years, in the sense that they argue that this includes Polanyi, but it would also include Marxists, that it ultimately disguises the fact that the economy is shot through with power relations and politics and political instruments of law and particularly property rights, but also all the forms of privatization and enclosure that went on to try and produce this kind of seemingly separate space of a free market. And that's what the Polanyi and Marxist critique of these institutions suggests. Now, the distinction with neoliberalism is that the neoliberal vision doesn't necessarily recommend that kind of separation of politics from economics, because it treats everything as economics. So it treats the state really as simply a kind of set of managerial institutions which need to be designed in the best way so as to boost an overall sense of enterprise, competitiveness, efficiency throughout society at large. And the state ceases to actually retain its own kind of political, institutional, public logic. First of all, this is a threat to, I think, neoliberalism by suggesting this kind of collapse of the distinction between the economy and the state. First of all, leads to a potential for a type of cronyism and a type of increasingly sort of illegitimate model of politics in which, through forms of privatization and public-private partnership, and ultimately, I think now we're seeing a kind of clientelism develop under the Johnson-Cummings regime, where the kind of friends of the government get handed contracts, often without the kind of procurement procedures that we've seen in the past. And this leads to a sort of general loss of any kind of sense of the credibility of public political institutions as things which actually have their own logic and their own identity independently of the sphere of the market and the sphere of business. Now, I suppose the importance of this for the book is that I think that the argument which I would defend about liberalism is that, at the very least, the liberal model of the past involved the possibility of there being separate spheres of society, the separation of the state from the economy, at least as a kind of principle that could be upheld. But I think that equally, of course, the other crucial ideal of liberalism is of a separation of powers. This is something which famously within the American Constitution and so on is that the judiciary is independent of parliament, which is independent of the executive. These are also separations which are under attack at the moment. And we see this not only with the sort of confrontation with the Supreme Court that we've seen by the Johnson administration, but also a sort of general kind of sidelining of parliamentary sovereignty, particularly since the Brexit referendum, or a sort of treatment of a parliament as somehow kind of hostile to the public public interest. So what we're seeing is a kind of gradual sort of coagulation of power into the executive branch of government, which is a really quite a long-standing trend that neoliberalism, dating back to Thatcher, has been pulling towards. But I think that what this trend does is it leads to a gradual kind of hollowing out of public institutions, which liberalism, at least in its idealized forms, represents a kind of check upon, because it also represents the kind of institutions that will exist outside of the economic space.
I've been thinking about your work today, actually, not just in preparation for the podcast, but I'm using it in a book that I'm writing. And I know that Paul Mason loves your definition of neoliberalism too, as the disenchantment of politics by economics. And I think you can unravel that a bit in lots of different ways. I mean, if you look at something like the climate crisis, the emergence of neoliberalism in the 1990s coincides with climate change becoming recognized as this really important, crucial issue that the world needed to act, or catastrophes were lying ahead. And that required a definition of the role of politics as being in pursuit of a general or public interest, a public authority. And so if you see politics as completely subordinate to the market rationalities, it's almost promoting a doctrine or ideology that's completely antithetical to dealing with the climate crisis, because it requires this sense of the ecological good or the ecological interest or the public good.
I think that that's absolutely the case. And the central problem of neoliberalism, and this is something which I discuss in my first book, The Limits of Neoliberalism, is that all problems are to be treated via the lens of economics in one way or the other, so that they can be solved or viewed and best scrutinized via the language of incentives, of efficiency. Even movements on the centre-left or policy agendas of the centre-left have tended to use the logic of market failure to try and understand what is the role for government and where should government go, which is a concept that derives from welfare economics. And effectively what this does is, if we think of a classical, I should be careful of saying classical liberal, because that's now become a sort of motif of sort of libertarians like Daniel Hannan and that kind of thing. But if we think of the classically liberal faith in procedural justice and the institutions of the constitution that defend the publicness of political procedures and of spaces of political deliberation, these are sort of ideals of liberal political theorists such as Habermas and others. Effectively, what neoliberalism does, by contrast to that, is to turn politics into something rather more kind of algorithmic, in the sense that questions of what is the right and the wrong political decision, or the right and wrong policy intervention, come down to calculations based on the analysis of data and on the modelling of predicted outcomes. So if you take something like the climate crisis, which is your example, it turns the question of the best way of alleviating this kind of huge collective action problem, or this ultimately global political challenge, into a extremely esoteric expert set of questions and disputes regarding the techniques and the predicted outcomes of often rather distant forms of intervention at the level of different types of incentive, different tweaking of market interventions and so on. And it means that basically some of the most important questions of politics and some of the most decisive areas of public policymaking are converted into technocratic problems in need of solutions, and are no longer really things which actually involve any kind of broader public at all. And I think this is the political crisis that neoliberalism ultimately generates, is to turn many of the most important questions of public policy into technical matters that are best handled by a narrow class of experts or elites behind closed doors, out of the public eye, or there might be a kind of a public going on around them, but really a rather sort of narrowly defined expert public. And the kind of classic case of this in space of economic policy would be in central banking, where central banks have been handed more and more and more power over the last 30 years, to a point where there are now people who would argue with some justification that central banks, you know, have to be kind of now mobilized to treating some of these sort of chronic problems such as global warming and so on. But the kind of emptying out of the liberal public sphere is accompanied by rising responsibilities and powers
for this type of calculative specialist who deals in the tweaking of incentives and the building of models and the treating the society and public life via the lens of a kind of utilitarian calculus.
It's funny, I remember, this sounds like a non sequitur, but it isn't. Like 8 years ago, like 2012 or even 2011, I remember Ann Pettifer saying that politicians used to be really sexy. You know, in the 70s and 80s, they were really sexy, and now they were totally unsexy. And it wasn't because they looked any different. It was because you could smell that they didn't have the power anymore. They were only sexy in the first place just because you could kind of smell power on them. And I feel like the past 4 years, there's been a kind of unfolding of something that we all already knew, which brings me to my question. You know, the book is structured around these three long read essays, and it has this time machine quality because they were written contemporaneously. Presumably you didn't go back and change anything, but is there anything you wanted to change when you read them back? And do you kind of feel like there was wisdom in there that you didn't realise how true it was until it happened?
These are pieces that were written often in quite rapid response. I mean, the very first one was written on the day after the referendum. And I think that that brings a certain kind of freshness, and it also hopefully gives some sense of how things looked and perhaps also how things felt at the time. And there are errors in, there were things which I got badly wrong. I mean, there's a piece which originally appeared in the London Review of Books about Theresa May and the Home Office, and that appeared in the autumn of 2016 when she was really riding high. I mean, sort of Gove and Johnson had disappeared with their tails between their legs, and she'd ridden in on this post-referendum wave and gave this really quite, at the time, quite extraordinary conference speech that she gave in the autumn of 2016, which is remembered particularly for that, if you think you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere claim. And anyway, I wrote this analysis of Theresa May in particular, and linking her philosophy and vision back to her time at the Home Office, because she'd been Home Secretary for 5 years, which was a very long time to be Home Secretary compared to so many of her predecessors and successors. And it sort of talked about how, you know, this is a sort of new hegemony forming, and she could be even more successful than Margaret Thatcher. And of course, you know, she'd blown it within kind of 9 months then. So that was a sort of, that was a, one of those things which was a kind of bad call, which is sort of inevitable. But again, I think it probably did sort of look like that at the time. No, I think otherwise, I didn't do a sort of Cummings and go back and edit my past blog post to try and make myself look more prescient than I was. And I'm sort of satisfied with how it sort of went. I think in some ways, most of the general sense of the direction of travel, I think, remained fairly consistent throughout. The book is split into these three phases. The turning points are, well, first of all, it begins with the Brexit referendum. Phase one goes the whole way through to the general election of the following summer. Phase two goes through to the spring of 2019, which was basically when Theresa May's number was finally up, because that's when the Brexit Party was riding high, when she had to ask for another 6 months extension from the European Union. And that was what then kind of provided the platform for Boris Johnson to effectively absorb the Brexit vote and create this still really rather kind of remarkable sort of Tory, not majority in the country, but there is the kind of 40%+ of people who are still pretty loyal to the Tories in spite of anything, was born at that point. So those are the three different phases. And I think that the direction of travel was fairly clear. What obviously I couldn't have predicted was that effectively many of the forces that broke open the liberal kind of elite hold on public life with the 2016 referendum were then kind of reassembled with the Johnson campaign in the winter of 2019. And that includes Cummings, but it also includes a certain sort of new kind of mischievous approach to the use of public information and the media.
And if we could talk about some of the specifics in different aspects of this history over the last 4 years. I mean, in the essay on the aftermath of 2016, it would be cruel of me to point out that you say that there's no reason the Labour heartlands won't stay red. Because in fact, actually, the way you discuss what became known in 2019 as the Red Wall seats really felt very prescient on what came afterwards. You know, you highlight these are almost places that liberalism forgot and didn't care about in its pre-2016 form. And you have this difference between redistribution and recognition that I thought was really interesting. Could you tell us about that?
The discussion that you're alluding to is where I'm trying to make a fairly kind of rapid response analysis of what's taken place on the night of the referendum. First of all, I, like lots of people, was rather sort of distracted by the fact that there were these extremely high Leave votes in places like the North East and South Wales and these kind of areas, which got a lot of media discussion. And it also kind of provoked a lot of the kind of David Goodhart sort of analysis of the world, that there was these sort of anywhere versus somewhere kind of places. And there was a lot of discussion. And I sort of mentioned, you know, because Hartlepool and Sunderland and these sorts of places, and Boston, Lincolnshire, the north, up the kind of North Sea coast, these places where the Leave vote sort of got towards the sort of high 60%, that sort of result. Now, of course, as Danny Dawling actually was very quick to point out, and I wasn't, there's no way Leave could possibly have won if they hadn't also swept up vast swathes of the sort of prosperous southeast. People, there's huge numbers of these basically quite comfortably off home-owning pensioners across Sussex and Surrey and the very rich parts of the rural southeast around places like Poole and these kind of places did actually vote for Remain. But there were these other sort of large areas of Oxfordshire and all sorts of other places that voted for Leave and didn't get nearly as much media discussion. At the time, people were quite focused on these Labour voting heartlands and how some of these kind of political sympathies seem to kind of correlate to the former coal fields and the former shipbuilding cities of the North East and steel manufacturing areas of South Wales and so on. So there seemed to be a kind of melancholic aspect to this that at the time corresponded also to what Donald Trump seemed to be doing across the Midwest and so on. Now, I think that the conceptual distinction that you refer to is something that I borrowed from Nancy Fraser, the critical theorist, who wrote an article on redistribution and recognition, I think, for the New Left Review around about 2000. But she's written quite a lot, and she's had various exchanges with Axel Honneth and others about the concept of recognition and how it needs to be balanced against ideas of redistribution on the left. And ultimately, the meaning of redistribution is relatively clear, particularly to anyone interested in political economy or on the left, which is that it's a material balancing out, whether it's done in terms of welfare payments or whether it's done in some other type of economic policy intervention. Recognition is, in Honneth's philosophy, it's about how you come to view yourself as a fully fledged human being, is that you require other people to recognize you. And that as you develop psychologically, in Honneth's account, and you then require forms of recognition that involve a greater and greater level of publicness, and that in the public sphere, which is where liberals have paid so much attention over history, recognition is how cultural merit is distributed. So it's how particular traditions of the arts, particular artists, particular novelists, musicians, whatever it might be, but also where particular democratic demands, when they receive recognition, that is to validate them in some way. It doesn't necessarily mean that they get what they demand, but that merely the provision of recognition to a political demand or the provision of recognition to a cultural artifact is to grant it a level of validity that is, as far as theorists such as Honneth and in a different way Fraser understand it, is central to granting them a sense of security and a sense of identity. Now, one of Fraser's warnings is that politics of recognition that goes too far and abandons the politics of redistribution becomes a kind of identity politics where all you're doing is recognizing the whole time and you're not actually accompanying that with any kind of material redistribution. And, you know, if we come back to this question of the Red Wall, the risk is that these sort of Red Wall seats will only get given recognition. You know, they'll be tossed bits of sort of culture war titbits where, you know, oh, all they want is people to wear more poppies or to have more kind of World War II bombers flying overhead or whatever it might be. And I think there's a real question as to whether this sort of levelling up agenda, which is the kind of redistribution bit, is actually going to sort of be serious or whether there will just be sort of a bit more cultural recognition. And you can't feed yourself off cultural recognition. But I think that it's clear that there were large swathes of the country, and my point in that piece was that what New Labour was quite good at dealing in material welfare. They had a lot of economists dealing in sort of studying inequality and so on, and they did reduce inequality at various points in their term in office, and they did alleviate poverty. But perhaps the argument that Brexiteers would make would be that, but was there actually the voices of these people actually heard in the public sphere and in politics and in the media and so on? And clearly we live in an age where the desire to be heard is something that seems to be extremely potent at the moment, regardless of the implications for the economy or for welfare.
I mean, I just want to linger on that Danny Dawling point for a second before I go to the next question. It's very clear why these areas that haven't had recognition might go the way politically that they've gone, but it's still not clear to me what's gone wrong with boomers. Because it seems to be really calcifying into a kind of very anti-elitist, anti-establishment body of opinion without the corresponding insults to their well-being that other segments of the society have had.
Don't you think, though, that in some ways the upper middle-class Eurosceptic vote was, one way of reading it anyway, was the solid base that Leave was always going to have, i.e. traditional middle-class Tory Euroscepticism was always going to deliver a reasonable vote for Leave, and it's a historic thing that goes back to Margaret Thatcher and the Bruges speech.
But in a way, I'm not even talking about Brexit anymore. I'm talking about a kind of radicalism in that segment of society. You know, suddenly they think all young people are responsible for COVID. Suddenly they want to bring back the death penalty. You know, there's a kind of real splenetic rage about the younger generation in every poll you see. And then you think, what? How did that happen?
I mean, I think there's various things going on here. And there's a couple of pieces in the book about one of the pieces, which I call Britain's Rentier Alliance, which is to do with the types of businesses that supported Vote Leave and Johnson, which is the, you know, JCB and Wetherspoons and these sorts of companies, plus hedge fund capital. And that then a lot of the people who are most militantly in favour of leaving and Johnson are the well-off homeowners with large pensions based on decades of stock market growth. So in that sense, there's a sort of an alliance of forces at large who, because somehow asset prices seem to kind of defy gravity. I mean, I turned on the radio the other day to hear that house prices are still rising, and that it's almost like, so we've had the biggest financial crisis in 80 years, and that didn't do anything ultimately to house price growth. Then we've got the largest pandemic in 100 years, and that doesn't seem to be doing it. I mean, is it going to take a sort of nuclear apocalypse before house prices stop rising? And there's a sort of sense of a kind of imperviousness of the people who have basically benefited from this 30 plus years of asset price growth, where they don't really sort of have any kind of stake in the open market. They don't need to be liberals. They don't need to be less dilded. They need to be cosmopolitans. I mean, it's also heavily male. I mean, it's worth thinking about that as well, that if you look at the studies that people like Tim Bale were doing of the conservative selectorate that voted for Johnson, and also some of the kind of studies of authoritarian values amongst Leave voters, to slightly kind of caricature it, but I mean, there is sort of polling data behind this. You know, there's a bunch of men over the age of 50 who effectively think that, I mean, you're kind of alluding to this, Zoe, who think that, you know, that the young have got it too good, that political correctness has gone wild, that we should bring back flogging. And it's also tied up with a certain amount of Islamophobia as well. And I mean, that's obviously a caricature. But actually, if you look at the attitudinal surveys that have been done amongst Conservative Party members, and particularly the older Leave voters, it's not a million miles away from the truth. Now, I think the other thing which is worth just thinking on a little bit is one of the things that comes out most strongly from the psychological studies of populism, for want of a better word, is that it correlates closely to what's called relative deprivation, which is that people who are most sympathetic to the right-wing populace around the world are people who've not necessarily people who've fallen behind in an absolute sense, because many of them haven't, but people who look around them and take the view that others have overtaken them to an illegitimate extent. And that may be, you know, racist rich people in America who are not happy about the fact that there are black middle class people who are doing better than them or are catching up with them, whatever it might be. But I think it also, if you think about what Piketty's work tells us about the structure of capitalism at the moment and about high incomes, if you look above you, everybody, the whole way up to Jeff Bezos, is if they look above them, the people above them are doing better than they are. Because the further you are up the income spectrum, the faster your income and wealth is rising. So if you want to feel relatively deprived and feel resentful, all you have to do is look at the people who are doing slightly better than you, and it will be the true that their income and wealth has been rising faster than yours. And that's true whether you're on sort of, you know, 15,000 a year or on 150 or 10 million a year. So I think there is this sort of internal logic of resentment that is built into this model of neoliberal capitalism. And I think that a lot of that resentment came out in the British context as an anti-London sentiment, because ultimately London was where the real action was. London is where the serious money was being made. London was also a centre of cosmopolitanism, of very high levels of immigration, of very high levels of diversity. In some ways, a kind of success story for all those things. It's become the Labour stronghold over the last 30 years. No one really predicted that Labour would become such a London-centric movement and political party, but that's what's happened. And it's also been a city of billionaires and skyscrapers and of a relatively successful multiculturalism. And I think that, you know, you could be someone who's sitting in a sort of £1 million house in Dorking and, you know, you're 65 years old and you've had a reasonable life, but you didn't get all of that and you didn't get all of that. And ultimately, you don't know why all the young people now have, you know, got, why they got all these tattoos and whatever it might be. There is, you can sort of see a psychology of resentment that is compatible with quite high levels of wealth and income, or wealth in particular.
So in a way, that does answer the question about the Tory Brexiteers who were supporters of liberalism in one country, and they have resolved that tension by junking liberalism. But in the same essay, there's this fascinating point about a future shock being the true test of Brexit. Is coronavirus that shock? And what do you think will happen? I mean, what do you think it does mean for Brexit?
It's a very good question. I mean, it struck me when writing that back in summer 2016, because there was a sort of bit of an eerie phase over that summer where it was, on the one hand, particularly Remainers felt, oh my God, the world has come to an end. But then also nothing really happened for a while. There wasn't an immediate recession in the way the Treasury had predicted and that kind of stuff. So there was this sort of weird, eerie mood of waiting for the crisis. And I suggest that there was an unambiguous loss of political power that was going to occur from breaking away from this vast trading bloc. Now, I think we're seeing kind of a sort of epic incompetence that the Johnson administration is now increasingly becoming characterised by. I find it hard to follow exactly where the Brexit negotiations are. I know there are these kind of specialists who keep up with it. I think that clearly the level of economic disaster that is coming down the track towards us and combined with a no deal strikes me as a sort of something the like of which, I mean, I don't even want to kind of imagine what that might mean. I mean, the state can prop things up for so long, but I haven't got a crystal ball. I don't know exactly what happens when a state loses the ability to actually manage its own economy, manage its own society in the case of pandemic. But I think how that intersects with Brexit, I'm still not quite clear to say. But I think that there is going to be a loss of control, ironically, given the mantra of Vote Leave.
One of the themes of the discussion so far has been this underlying authoritarianism that has animated the Brexit project and the basis for that in the electorate and so on. I mean, at one point in the book, I think it's the post-2017, post-Grenfell chapter, you note some polling at the time, and I doubt it's changed since, that shows 54% of Britons would like a strong leader prepared to break the rules. Now, I was thinking about that in the context of your discussion of liberalism, and in some ways, do you see the distinction between liberalism and neoliberalism as being, at least in part, this new form of neoliberalism that seems to be going through a rule-breaking evolution now? So basically, the rule of law system that liberalism depends on, now neoliberalism has evolved to a certain point where it's like, well, actually, we want to break as many rules as possible. We no longer want to be dependent on international law and so on. Now, this means that Brexit, authoritarianism and Johnson, it sort of feels like it's moving with the winds of history.
To go back to what I was saying earlier about neoliberalism, that if its defining feature is that it abandons the categorical distinction between the sphere of economics and the sphere of politics that was so important to liberalism, that what this does is that it turns one of the functions of particularly the executive branch of the state into something rather resembling entrepreneurship. And the kind of icon of neoliberal leadership is the disruptive, risk-taking entrepreneur, the Bezos or the Steve Jobs figure. There's also, incidentally, and this is something I talk a bit about in The Limits of Neoliberalism, but there is a kind of traffic back and forth, particularly in business schools, between the kind of lessons of military leadership and those of business leadership. So you get a kind of, you know, reading The Art of War as a sort of textbook about business strategy. And in my previous book, Nervous States, I talked about, in a way, what are these giant platforms leading us towards. It's a kind of Napoleonic leadership, a kind of empire building leadership built purely upon the will to command and to expand and to own, basically. That is really the model of what, say, a Bezos or a Zuckerberg is doing. Now, I think that, you know, entrepreneurs equally are rule breakers. That's what distinguishes them. If you read Joseph Schumpeter on entrepreneurship, what he finds so admirable about entrepreneurs is that they don't play by the rules. They tear up the rule book. While everybody else is getting on with their routines and their rather tedious bureaucratic procedures, the entrepreneur goes and just rearranges the entire game. And that's what Schumpeter found so exciting. And that, in a way, I think is sort of where the seems to be the Cummings vision. Cummings, for people who've read his whole blog over several years, say that he's very excited by the ideas of Friedrich Hayek. And Hayek was not that far from Schumpeter in terms of his faith in entrepreneurship. On a more libertarian end of it, you get the kind of people who are sort of fans of Ludwig von Mises. So these are the kind of three giants of Austrian economics of the 20th century, all of which effectively were kind of fairly right-wing enthusiasts for disruption and a fair amount of chaos that could be brought into some kind of order by entrepreneurial will. Johnson's lawlessness, I think, is more a function of his psychology and his inability to stick to routines or to stick to the truth or to stick to norms. And I think that that's why, effectively, Johnson couldn't really become prime minister under any other circumstances. Johnson is not a figure who has the power, charisma, or skill to break open a situation of institutional strength. He is someone who has exploited a situation of institutional chaos and decay, and his personality happens to be very well suited to a situation where norms and rules have been broken and abandoned, and he has allied himself to someone who is, I'm talking about Cummings, someone who clearly fancies himself as some kind of master game theorist and strategist, and is spending his evenings reading all sorts of dodgy texts by business strategists and libertarians.
That actually makes me feel a bit better about Boris Johnson for some reason. Like, he's not an evil person. He's merely the product, the inevitable product of his times. Anyway, talking of leaders, you note in the book that under a different Labour leader, Labour could very easily have won a coalition in 2019, or led a coalition rather. But obviously what happened instead was that Corbyn became this hate figure, both for hardcore Remainers and hardcore Leavers, and actually a lot of softcore Remainers and softcore Leavers. And I think certainly on the Remain side, we saw him as part of a fringe, a kind of Lexiteer fringe. But you actually present him more as a figure of the centre, you know, the people who don't really care about Europe, which used to be the normal stance on Europe. Can we talk a bit about Corbyn and how things did go wrong for him?
Well, I mean, I think things had already gone pretty badly wrong. I mean, I think the passage that you're referring to was that if we think back to just over a year ago, I mean, so much has happened. It seems like another world. But if you think back to September 2019, it seemed like everything was almost intractably stuck. I mean, Johnson obviously rode in the summer of last year as leader of the Conservative Party, and there was a lot of excitement about that, but there was still absolutely no idea of how he was going to resolve the problem of how to get his party to vote through some kind of deal that also coped with the Irish border problem and without a majority in Parliament. So there was this kind of totally intractable problem. And it also wasn't clear how he was going to get an election because of the Fixed Term Parliament Act. And then there was the attempt to prorogue Parliament, and obviously that put him on a collision course with the Supreme Court. The point I was making was that there was, under, say, inverted commas, normal circumstances, you could have imagined a coalition between the Liberal Democrats, the, I suppose, would have had to be the SNP as well, and the Labour Party to create some kind of coalition. But it would have had to involve Jeremy Corbyn as the Prime Minister. And I think that was clearly what the Liberal Democrats were not willing to sanction. So I think that Corbyn looked really terribly flat-footed through most of that summer and didn't really seem to have any real answers to any of these strategic problems. And there was this astonishing phase between March 2019 and the whole way through to, well, the proroguing of Parliament, but then through to the general election, where everything seemed to be up in the air the entire time. I mean, Johnson basically spent the summer trying to make as strongly kind of nationalistic noises as possible so as to reassemble the Leave vote, which, of course, ultimately is what won him that big majority in December. And while this was going on, I mean, there was a time, if you remember the polls, I mean, there was that astonishing European election in the May where the Brexit Party was the overwhelming winner. The Conservative Party looked like it was on course to being destroyed. And you had, throughout much of that summer, you had four parties all on the sort of low 20%, around about sort of 20, 25%, that kind of thing. And it really didn't look how that was going to be broken. And of course, Johnson found a way to break out of that, and Labour didn't. I mean, and that's kind of what, you know, roughly speaking, that was the problem, was that Labour didn't find a way of putting a large coalition back together again, and the Conservatives did. And in some ways, it was sort of brutally simple what the Conservatives had to do. What nobody really foresaw, I think, like nobody foresaw, was this deal that Johnson was able to cobble together, which he has now obviously thrown by the wayside, involving basically chucking Northern Ireland under the bus. So that was the big sort of surprise of the autumn of 2019. But my point about Corbyn was simply that, I mean, you know, I think he was, by that point, he was like a sort of rabbit trapped in the headlights. I think he was basically, John McDonnell allegedly was the one who persuaded him that they had to become a party of the second referendum. But Labour was stuck on sort of 25% or something in the polls through right the whole way through to the time of the election being called. So I don't know what the answer should have been. I certainly don't believe that Labour becoming a sort of leave party in the way that some people explain, oh, well, you know, the only reason they got trounced in December 2019 was because they weren't a party of leave, which is a very sort of comforting story to tell about why various different Redcar and Bolsover and these sorts of places got lost. But it's really not a story about why Labour didn't win a majority.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over just yet. An extended version of the pod is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we discuss the idea of neo-illiberalism. And we also reflect on the upcoming American elections and ask if authoritarianism still has a trump card to play. Excuse the terrible pun, but it is a really good chat. If you want to listen to that extra material, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the European left in Britain. We'd love you to join us. You can join at anothereurope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all, and it makes a really big difference. See you next time.
I suppose this is an expansion, further expansion of what we've been talking about throughout, really. But you have this nice reference to neo-illiberalism in the book. Could you tell us a bit about that? And do you think it's a new normal, not just in Britain, but perhaps internationally?
Yeah, I mean, this term neo-illiberalism is a concept that I originally came across by the work of Raja Hendrikse, who's a political economist who has been writing about, or political scientist, writing about the rise of a particular model of populist leadership in places such as Hungary and elsewhere. And I think that what it refers to is that what you can see in this particular form of authority is an appeal to the popular will. So it has a kind of at least a rhetorical claim to be upholding democracy, but it is also an attack on the institutions that uphold norms of legality and human rights and procedures and the norms of public life that actually necessarily have a certain kind of democratic deficit about them. So the independence of the judiciary becomes the ultimate affront to this type of populist leadership.
Let's talk about the US, though, because obviously this is the sharp end of the new politics. How important to all of this is what happens there in a few weeks' time?
Well, it clearly has a kind of huge symbolic resonance in terms of the extent to which these forces of reactionary nationalism, to what extent is their ascendancy kind of guaranteed, or to what extent can it actually be averted? Of course, the forces that put Trump where he is and which are still behind him, they're not going to go away. And I think that if you read people like Richard Seymour in his blogging, I mean, he's sort of identifying all of the different ways in which Trump is giving off cues to militias to take up arms in the event of, well, maybe perhaps either whether he wins or he doesn't win. I mean, obviously the comment he made in the debate about right-wing militias is sort of effectively kind of inviting them to stand by. And that's not going to go away. But I think clearly a Biden presidency at least would represent a kind of pause on this dismantling of the liberal post-war era that we've been witnessing elsewhere.
Something really corrosive to the liberal spirit is that we feel like we're on this accelerating train towards a different and really dark politics, but I kind of want to see what happens. Do you know what I mean?
The fascination with crisis.
Yeah.
I think there is a dark fascination that we all feel a little bit about something like Trump. And in a way, Trump, after all, is a reality TV star, and he runs his campaigns like a reality TV channel. He cooperates with Fox News because they are the main distributor of his reality TV show of the Trump presidency. And I think that in a way, what he's sort of partly inviting people to do is to kind of buy a second series, you know, sort of renew the subscription sort of thing. And there is a kind of sense that that's kind of how this type of politics works, is that it is eye-catching, it's engaging, and it's occasionally entertaining. And Johnson himself has a similar type of political authority. I mean, there's an essay in the book about stand-up comedy as the kind of model of this type of political charisma, in the sense that it exists in real time. It involves kind of instant audience affective responses, and that it involves type of a political rhetoric, which involves stories that are presented as true, but everyone kind of knows aren't true. And that's a sort of particular space that people like Trump and Johnson inhabit. There's nothing hugely exciting about the idea of Keir Starmer becoming prime minister. I think that these in some ways are kind of luxuries that, whether or not politics is exciting or not, should be fairly far down the list of things that we expect of politicians. And actually, this kind of aestheticization of politics is ultimately quite dangerous. But I agree that we're all, I think, slightly vulnerable to it.
I like the idea that the absurdist theatre of these new times kind of has somehow this subliminal attractiveness in response to the sort of mundane boredom of everyday life. You get, wow, that Simpsons episode from 2000 where Donald Trump is president. Wow, entertainment has suddenly come to life. This is really strange. And I mean, looking ahead, I don't think even in the year 2000 anyone would have predicted the Donald Trump presidency of 2016, except as a joke. So clearly, in that relatively short period of time, historically, there was some kind of massive disruption. You talk in the book about Brexit as a delayed response to the financial crisis. I know none of us are really in the prediction game here, but is it too early to say what the downstream disruptions of coronavirus will be?
Well, I think that one thing that's happening, the combination of coronavirus and Johnson and Brexit, I think, is accelerating the loss of trust in the institutions of mainstream politics, for want of a better word, and of the public sphere and of the media. I think the sort of normalization of a kind of paranoid mentality, I think, is gathering pace in the context of this pandemic. I mean, so for one thing, many people, not conspiracy theorists, people who follow the media, follow the news, are not people who sort of think that all politicians are sort of chronic liars, but really would believe that Donald Trump has not had coronavirus. Equally, I know of people who, and I've seen this on Twitter as well, people who are not who you'd automatically imagine to be either on the radical left or the radical right, to be sort of deeply suspicious of all types of official information, but who refuse to use the NHS test and trace app because they don't think that it's quite what it seems to be. They think it's not the NHS, it's a type of surveillance, it's not actually kind of telling us quite the truth about what it's being used for. I think that mentality has taken hold quite substantially before 2016, and that's partly because people were able to distribute these sorts of ideas and theories more easily via Facebook and YouTube. But I think there's a real risk at the moment that it becomes almost a kind of common sense. And that's where, of course, there are sort of some of these sort of liberal redoubts of places like the BBC, which are also under great pressure at the moment. But we can see that there's a sort of version of, not liberal democracy, but let's say that neoliberalism that was mentioned earlier. But you see in kind of the situation of, say, Russia or something, and people like Peter Pomerantsev and others have written about that sense of living in a world where, and it goes back to the classic Hannah Arendt definition of a public that is vulnerable to totalitarianism, as one where people have given up trying to distinguish between truth and falsehood, but living in a world where you're constantly bombarded by impressions and which you know that they're not total fictions, but at the same time, you don't also think they're quite what they seem either. And that's a kind of a sensibility that I think many of us have really kind of internalized to a far greater extent. And I think that the coronavirus pandemic, I mean, pandemics have always yielded conspiracy theories, but I think that the coronavirus pandemic is really sort of exacerbating that. And I think that the sort of triple whammy of Brexit, Johnson, and then a pandemic is producing these kind of sanctuaries that people form in sort of WhatsApp groups and via various communities, and even in things like the QAnon conspiracy theory, where people effectively are going elsewhere in search of their ideas of what's going on and coming to view all official statements as dubious. Now, you can see why. I'm not sort of here to condemn that. I think that you can see the structural conditions of that have been deepening and expanding and are accelerating at the moment. And I think that this is really very worrying. But I can't say exactly where that leads. I'm not trying to say that we're on the brink of a sort of Orwellian nightmare. But at the same time, I think that there will be periodic eruptions of quite surreal behavior of, you know, we might see periodic or quite frequent protest movements develop seemingly out of nowhere, but basically from online groups and online conspiracy theories, taking aim at different institutions, whether it be the BBC or the police or 5G or whatever it might be. I think that's going to become a normal part of our politics. And then, of course, the question will always be there, to what extent will it be tempting for a figure like Johnson to try and actually engage with some of those groups when they become big enough?
It's going to be so interesting to watch it all unfold, at least.
Yeah, so long as I'm entertained, everything's all right.
But thanks so much, Will. That was great. Really good to talk to you.
Yeah. And congratulations on the book. I really do think it's brilliant.
Oh, thank you very much. Great. Well, thanks for having me.